This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at The Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. After the long, sometimes bitter primary campaign, a sizable fraction of Senator Hillary Clinton's supporters remain angry and resentful. At the Democratic National Convention in Denver last night, she thanked them and asked them to move on.
I want you to ask yourselves, were you in this campaign just for me? Or were you in it for that young Marine and others like him? Were you in it for that mom struggling with cancer while raising her kids? Were you in it for that young boy and his mom surviving on the minimum wage? Were you in it for all the people in this country who feel invisible?
For some, Hillary's speech was an eloquent call to unite behind Barack Obama. Others remain unpersuaded. We'll talk about reactions to her speech, whether the message extended beyond the convention hall, and we want to talk about the historical context. Senator Obama argues we're in a post-racial era, past the battles of the 1960s. Others disagree. In that same context, are we post-gender? We want to hear from you on this. What did Senator Clinton's candidacy mean for women's rights and feminism? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We'll get comments from members of the audience here at the Newseum as well. We begin with Farai Chidea, the host of NPR's News and Notes. She's been covering the Democratic National Convention at the ground level and joins us now from NPR's headquarters at the DNC in Denver. Nice to have you on the program.
So delighted.
And what was the feeling last night during Senator Clinton's speech?
You know, I have been there for just days and nights seeing people arrive, and it was so packed last night. It was unbelievable. It may not be Invesco where you're going to have 75,000 people, but it was as packed as it's going to be. And some people were there just to see what she would say, and some people were there in tears, literally, because the person that they thought would be the first female president is not going to be.
Well, she won more votes than anybody who did not win the nomination of her party, and more states, too. A very close-run campaign, as it turned out. Last night, after it was apparent that Senator Obama was going to win the nomination and Senator Clinton would not, do you think she sold the deal to her supporters?
Some people say yes, who you talk to. Some delegates say yes, and some say no. I think it depends on how passionate they are about Senator Obama as a figure who represents an equally important icon, this idea of the first black president. Some of the people who feel that way think that she didn't quite go far enough in stressing that her criticisms of him during the campaign were, say, unfounded. But you've got Joe Biden, who was also a competitor, dropped out much earlier, of course, and he said things about Obama. So I expect tonight, of course, that he will backtrack a bit more. But some people think that she didn't go quite far enough. Most people seem satisfied who I talked to.
And Clinton supporters, how did they break out on this?
Well, you know, I talked to some very interesting women, and this brings up the issue of race. After the speech last night, I went and just went up to groups of women, particularly one group of white women from New York and North Carolina. And the woman from North Carolina really was adamant that not she, but many people she knew who were Clinton supporters were not going to vote for Obama, and some of them actively campaigning now for McCain in that battleground state. The one from New York said, we're happy about this, but sometimes you just think, at least couldn't she be vice president? The African-American women from Texas, delegates from Texas, one of them only 21 years old, basically were like, it's all good. Let's move on.
It's interesting. During her address last night, she made a direct appeal, you'd have to think, the way she couched it, to African-American women.
So well, how do we give this country back to them? By following the example of a brave New Yorker, a woman who risked her lives to bring slaves to freedom along the Underground Railroad. On that path to freedom, Harriet Tubman had one piece of advice. If you hear the dogs, keep going. If you see the torches in the woods, keep going. If they're shouting after you, keep going. Don't ever stop. Keep going. If you want a taste of freedom, keep going.
And that of course, had to have a lot of resonance for African-American women.
It was definitely an appeal directly to African-American women, but also to try to bridge that divide of what some call intersectionality when gender and race collide, which you don't have to be a woman or black to see that there are differences between how black women and white women or non-black women see this. In fact, in an odd sense, as I talked to people, including people who were Native American delegates, I talked to a woman from the Pueblo Nation in New Mexico, it seems as if in some ways there was a divide more between white women and non-white women, in the sense that all the women of color I spoke with, no matter what color that was, really identified with the racial issues as much as or more than gender, and the reverse was true for white women.
Did you feel that those women of color resented being put on the spot, choose between your color and your gender?
Some of them have, but more of the people I spoke with, including some people we brought onto our show a couple days ago, really resented the idea that history could be erased, in the sense that black women had to go through a three-stage movement to get the right to vote. First, you had literally the Emancipation Proclamation, which said black people are citizens and human beings. Then you had the women's suffrage movement, which meant that black women technically had the right to vote, but then not until the civil rights movement really did most black women, think of Fannie Lou Hamer, have the right to shape American politics. So there has been a very different path to political empowerment for black women than there have been for most other women in America. And some people feel that history was not stressed enough.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Carolyn. Carolyn with us from Akron in Ohio.
Hi. I really loved Hillary's speech last night, especially when she said, "Were you in it for me, or were you in it for," and then she gave those examples, because that is my exact feeling with these Hillary supporters who are just will not support Obama. It's selfish. I mean, we cannot afford four more years or however many more years of someone who doesn't support a woman's right to choose, someone who doesn't support equal pay for equal work. And Hillary, I think, did a wonderful job. It's not about, oh, I'm taking my jacks and going home because, you know, you're not playing the way I want to play. It's supposed to be about everyone. It's again, I can understand people's anger. I feel Hillary was given, she had the sexist comments made, and I was angry too, but I cannot, in good conscience, support John McCain. I just can't.
Farai Chidea, I wonder, when you talk to that woman again from North Carolina who said that maybe not her, but some people she knows would abandon the Democratic Party and vote for John McCain this time around because of the way this campaign turned out, did they respond to those points?
Well, I think that some of what you find is the "I'm not racist, but" argument. You know, I'm not racist, but that person over there. And we also, again, on our show, ran some tape of a woman who basically told Senator Obama that Africans were responsible for slavery, and don't lecture me as a white woman on racial issues. That said, there are also a lot of other fault lines. There are ways in which Senator Clinton had a more centrist record, or at least more centrist rhetoric, than Senator Obama, if only by a hair. And I think that comforted some people. So the racial issue is one thing, and the political issue is another.
Thanks very much for the call, Carolyn. Let's see if we can go now to, we'll go to Mary. Mary's on the line with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hello, how are you today?
And very
well.
Thank
you for taking my call.
Very well, thank you.
I just want to say the phenomenal speech that Hillary Clinton gave last night was awesome. My vote was going to be no for Barack. I am leaning more towards him now, and I think Thursday will break that bridge for me.
Mary, what in particular in Senator Clinton's speech last night made you think that?
I think when she said that you just keep moving on, it was when she said how Harriet Tubman said, if the dogs are behind you, keep going. And it just, It was a force that made me feel that, yes, we need to do this in order to change what is happening in this country, because it's not going to get any better.
And will you be listening tomorrow night when Senator Obama speaks?
Almost definitely. That is the time when I would definitely make my final decision. I was totally against up until last night. I am leaning towards this direction as of now.
Mary, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that raises a point. How much beyond that hall in Denver for Aisha Day do you think that Senator Clinton's remarks extended?
All the way to the moon. I mean, people are watching this so closely. And I do want to bring up something else that really struck me, which is that essentially two paragraphs, not that a speech has paragraphs, but a transcription does, two paragraphs before the Harriet Tubman bit of the speech, she said, "My mother was born before women could vote. My daughter got to vote for her mother for president. This is the story of America, of women and men who defy the odds and never give up." Now, that also links to a story that she told us on News and Notes right before the South Carolina primary, a heavily black state, which Obama won, decisively turned at least part of the tide. And she said to us that her mother essentially would have been put in the foster care system if it was a different time. And she talked about how her mother was essentially abandoned at the age of 8, then moved on to be a domestic servant at the age of 14, and how although she, meaning Hillary Rodham Clinton, was comfortable, she could identify with this woman who lifted herself directly out of a path to lack of self-fulfillment. And so I think that she has some stories that perhaps she did not tell enough to a wider audience.
For Aisha Day, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And have fun at the convention.
I will.
For Aisha Day, the host of NPR's News and Notes, she will be with us today from NPR's headquarters at the Democratic National Convention in Denver. We're talking about reaction to Hillary Clinton's speech last night and what her campaign meant for women's rights and for feminism. 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're broadcasting today live from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Sometime later today, the Democratic National Convention will formally nominate Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee for president. That will mean the end of Senator Hillary Clinton's campaign, and it will be a difficult moment for many of the women who support her. What did Senator Clinton's candidacy mean for women's rights and feminism? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, and we'll be getting comments from our members of our audience here at the Newseum as well. Joining us now is Susan Faludi, a Pulitzer Prize and National Book Critics Circle award-winning journalist and author. Her recent op-ed in the New York Times is titled Second Place Citizens, and she joins us now from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And we were talking about reaction from delegates on the floor with Farai Chidea just a moment ago. Did that same message, do you think, get out beyond Denver?
Well, I'm not a pollster, so and one of the things that struck me and was very frustrating in watching the coverage last night was, at least on the TV networks, there wasn't a whole lot of reporters running around asking people. They were mostly talking to each other. So I think, you know, time will tell. But I certainly thought it was I can't imagine a more gracious passing of the baton.
We get calls from some Obama supporters who say they can't understand why it's so difficult for some Hillary Clinton supporters to get over this. Could you put this in some historical context for us?
Yes. Well, you know, first of all, obviously, saying I'm going to take my ball and go home, or worse, saying I'm going to vote for McCain doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But where that's coming from is a deep well of anger, and that anger is not so much related to Obama versus Clinton as it is to a much longer history of women's struggle in this country, where they seem to be close to breaking through, seem to be on the verge of that meaningful transformational change, only to be knocked back. And ironically, the best example of this is suffrage. Ironic, since Hillary Clinton was speaking on the 88th anniversary of suffragist certification, as she pointed out. And women's suffrage was supposed to be the big breakthrough. And yet in the years to follow, it was pretty much of a collapse on every front. The women's voting bloc didn't emerge. Women were not able to break into the political parties. Very few women were able to get into higher office. The sort of symbol of it all was probably Rebecca Felton, an 87-year-old woman from Georgia, who was allowed to warm the seat of a new senator for one day. That was how long her tenure in the Capitol lasted. And on many other fronts, economically, in the professions, in the media, women were set back in the years to come. And as we know, there were, you know, the next wave of feminism wasn't until the end of the 60s.
As you wrote in the Times, every time it seemed to come up, women at least have the perception of being told, hey, wait your turn.
Mm-hmm. It's the old Wizard of Oz moment where Dorothy is told, go away and come back tomorrow. And the women who are, particularly older women who are Hillary Clinton supporters, have had a lifetime of this, of being told, your issues aren't important. You're complaining about silly things. This is trivial. And these are women who have struggled their whole life and have come from a period pre-feminism and know how bad things can get when they slip back. And on many fronts, and very much unacknowledged in the press, women are slipping back. Economically, women's earnings have dropped for the last four consecutive years. Women in political leadership we're still at the bottom of the heap compared to other developed countries. And women in fields from journalism to computer science to directing Hollywood movies to management have seen their progress either stall out or actually erode.
Let's get a question from here in the audience at the museum.
Hi, I'm Rachel, and I live in Washington, D.C. Last night, Hillary Clinton opened her speech by stating she's a proud mother. Michelle Obama also made references to being a mother. And I'm wondering, have we not moved beyond the point where a woman politician has to be a wife and mother first, and then she can be a politician?
Well, I think in Hillary Clinton's case, since she was introduced by her daughter, it seemed appropriate. And she did move on immediately to say, I'm a proud Democrat, I'm a proud this, I'm, you know, proud in the political arena, and ended it by saying, you know, I'm proud to be an Obama supporter. For Michelle Obama, she, you know, she had an assignment, a task ahead of her, which was to present herself as not a quote-unquote angry woman, because that's how the media had presented her. And she was, you know, her mission was to soften her image. That said, I thought it was really unfortunate that she had to talk so much about being a mom and a wife and a sister and a, you know, all of these, you know, sort of assuring the public that she had no aspirations and no anger. And what's wrong with being angry? We all should be very angry with what has happened in this country in the last 8 years.
Let's get a caller on the line. Kelly, join us. Kelly with us from Placerville in California.
Yes, hi. I want to say that I think identifying Hillary Clinton as a feminist is a bit overblown from my point of view, because I feel that the majority of her work in her life was promoting Bill's career, you know, one she could have been working on her own. I mean, he was the one who ran for office. He was the one who became president and governor and president and so forth. And, you know, I also think we need to pay homage to the women who really broke ground before Hillary Clinton. I mean, there was Pat Schroeder, who made a, you know, valiant effort toward presidency in the 70s. There was Shirley Chisholm and Patsy Mink, who, you know, weren't taken seriously but should have been. I mean, they were really valid candidates, you know. And now to speak of her as if she's a feminist, I know she, you know, hung out in feminist circles in Washington, D.C., but to, you know, for me, I just see her as somebody who worked her way up through her husband, and I don't really consider that so much of a feminist, something that feminists should necessarily applaud.
Susan Faludi, what do you think?
Well, you know, I agree that she's hardly presented herself as a fire-breathing feminist or the stereotype of the quote-unquote rabid feminist, whatever that is. But I think she's also a work in progress, and that over certainly over the course of the campaign when she was hit with a an avalanche of misogyny from the media and from her own, you know, political compatriots who told her to, you know, stand down and shut up, basically, that she has moved much more in the direction of being vocal about women's rights. And, you know, she has done work, a great deal of work, you know, starting with in 1995, the Conference on Women in Beijing, where she gave a very moving speech calling for women's rights, economic development for women around the globe. And she's worked very hard behind the scenes for that. And she's worked hard to, you know, for all kinds of things that really matter to women, like expanding Family Medical Leave Act, like work, you know, fighting workplace discrimination, like reproductive rights. So, you know, she's not Margaret Thatcher, and she's not Helen Reddy. But you know, you've got to work with what you have. And I think that over time she became a much more strongly committed advocate to women's rights.
Right, but I mean, I don't see it as a blow for feminism or for women that she didn't achieve the, you know, nomination, because.
Well, I don't, you know, I'm not presenting it as a blow for feminism. I think feminism has had taken so many blows, it's close to flat on its back by now anyway.
Yeah.
But that there's a great symbolic significance to that shouldn't be understated to having a first woman president, just as there's a very important symbolic statement to having a first black president. I mean, the crying shame of this election is that we have to choose, which is why I say bring back Shirley Chisholm.
Kelly, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Joining us now is Liz Winstead. She's a comedian, co-creator of The Daily Show, and the host of Thinking and Drinking with Liz Winstead. She joins us from the studios at Audio Ruckus in Minneapolis. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And I wondered what you thought of Hillary's speech last night.
Well, I guess I felt like, in listening to it, I felt like she was still on the stump. It was, this is what I did, this is what I did, this is what I did. And so, I mean, I hope that she can convince the people who are her supporters that have joined these groups called PUMA and these other groups, you know, these I'll vote for McCain instead of Obama. You know, I hope for that. I don't know if it's effective. It's just those people are puzzling to me. But, you know, there's a group of women who are feminists who a lot of people don't talk about. And they're women. I'm 47 and they're women my age who have sons and daughters who are between 17 and 25, who look at her war vote as a very detrimental thing. And when you look at the Hillary supporters who are of Hillary's age group and who came up through feminism with her age group, they don't have kids that could potentially have to go to a war. And those women really look at Hillary as selling out feminism and selling out their kids' futures, I think.
So a slight generational divide, yet at one point in her speech, clearly Hillary Clinton did make a direct appeal, it seemed to me anyway, to somewhat younger women. Let's listen to this cut.
To my supporters, to my champions, to my sisterhood of the traveling pantsuits, heart. Thank you.
And Liz Winstead, as a professional, that's a pretty good line.
It is a pretty good line, although I would like to see an end to the traveling pantsuit. In fact, I would like to see an end to the pantsuit, personally. You know, no more pantsuits, and especially in orange.
which was,
but
of
that's
course,
just a personal taste thing. That's just a personal taste thing.
For those who were listening on the radio last night, orange was the color of the pantsuit that she wore at the Democratic National Convention last night. We're talking with Liz Winstead and with Susan Faludi. We're discussing what Senator Clinton's campaign meant for women and for feminism. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Nancy. Nancy with us from Louisville in Kentucky.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, I'm in the middle of the baby boom. I'm 54. And I have not felt as strongly about Hillary, the first woman, the feminist thing, as some people around me who, everybody was shocked that I wasn't for Hillary. And I have sensed that they felt a whole lot stronger, and they're slightly older than I am. And I'm wondering if there's a breakdown, you know, baby boom, younger generations, different. I just haven't heard any numbers. It's all treated like women are all one age, and I don't know if that's actually true or not. I don't know whether women of all ages feel the same way.
Now, Liz Winstead, what do you think? I know you're not a pollster either.
I know I'm not a pollster. I guess for me, I have never been a Hillary Clinton fan sort of all along. She never was my candidate. And so I guess I feel like generationally there is a big issue. I think, you know, women identify with feminism so much differently now. So many young women don't identify with it at all. And, you know, it makes me think, for me, I feel like getting 18 million votes is pretty awesome. I mean, I think that's a pretty good sign that women are seeing the feminist glasses half full, thinking, wow, Hillary's not the candidate for me right now. But I feel very comfortable that in my lifetime I will see a woman as president. Maybe that's pie in the sky, but I do feel that way. And I think that, you know, I think to Susan's point when she said, you know, gosh, how unfortunate that we have these groundbreaking candidates. We have an African-American man and a woman at a time when, you know, there's so many other things going on that we have to look at, and we have to look at the woman's war vote. We have to look at the woman's support of the bankruptcy bill. You know, we have to look at the African Americans' experience and what we think that is. And you know, it's a difficult time to have groundbreaking candidates, I think.
Thanks very much for the call, Nancy. And I wanted to hear from Susan Faludi on this point as well as from you, Liz. Do you think that we're in a post-feminist period? Do you think that the battles of the 60s have been won and other things have happened? And I just think back to some of the things that Susan was saying about the wage gap growing over the past 4 years.
Yeah, we're hardly in some feminist mecca here. this term post-feminism, which, by the way, as scholars and in particular Harvard professor Nancy Kopp pointed out, the term post-feminism was coined in the 1920s. And looking back, that was hardly feminist mecca either. So I think post-feminism is something that's trotted out to say, hey, gals, you know, you don't have any problems anymore. If you do,
right,
it's just your own individual problems. So, you know, go home and shut up, basically. So no, I don't think we're in a post-feminist age. As far as, but you know, young women are not surprisingly, some young women. I know plenty of young women who are very committed to feminist change, but are they the majority? Probably not in a culture that rewards young women for distancing themselves from feminism. You know, uh-huh. Probably not in a culture that tells women has basically served up a kind of commercial form of women's liberation where you find yourself emancipated by advancing your self-esteem and feeling a sense of self-empowerment by shopping or putting Botox in your face. You know, in a culture that that is fixated on individualism and celebrity and being the object of adulation, it's a hard sell to say, why don't you embrace a feminism that is collective and more anonymous and is about bread and butter issues?
Well,
and I would also take it one step further. In a culture that has, there's this hipster quality of disconnect where it's very cool to not care. And so, you know, when it comes to that, and I've just, I had this sort of interesting experience on my show a couple of weeks ago.
And we're going to hear about that when we get back after a short break. Liz Winstead, please stay with us. Also, stay with us, Susan Faludi. We're going to talk more about what Hillary Clinton's candidacy meant for women's rights and for feminism. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll take more comments from the audience here at the museum as well. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about Hillary Clinton and the meaning of her candidacy for women and for feminism. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. Our guests are Susan Faludi, a journalist and author, a Pulitzer Prize and National Book Critics Circle Award winner, author most recently of The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America. She's with us from KQED, our member station in San Francisco. Also with us, Liz Winstead, a comedian, writer, and co-creator of The Daily Show, now a host of Thinking and Drinking with Liz Winstead. She's with us from Minneapolis. And Liz, just before the break, you were describing a story that you thought was illustrative.
I have a talk show in New York, and I invited on two women from Jezebel, which is a guest post feminism website, and a very popular website with young women. And the focus of that, and that is, seems really prevalent for me, for a lot of young women, is this sort of sexual freedom feminism, and its sole focus on just really aggressively sexual experiences and equating that with feminism. And I was sort of taken aback at the lack of responsibility that came with the advocating of sexual freedom. And it was an eye opening thing. I felt really old and I felt really, maternal. And, so I don't know. And I know that's just a small part of sort of the landscape of what young feminism is today, but I don't know if it's because it's, sexual freedom is sort of an easy one to fight for. You know, wage equity, workplace stuff is a little bit harder. So I don't know where we're at in, as far as where young women are putting their focuses when it comes to feminist issues.
Well, joining us now is Amy Richards, co-author of the book Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future, co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation, with us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And just to that point, is there a generational divide?
Well, I was just chuckling in my head because I was thinking maybe the reason we don't think of Hillary Clinton as a feminist is because we don't think of her as sexual. and maybe that explains why younger women feel disconnected. But I don't think there's truth to that. And I am 38, so in the context of this conversation, maybe feel a little bit young, but spend a lot of my time on college. Thanks. But because I spend most of my time on college campuses, I actually feel, like Liz, very old and maternal when I'm speaking with college students. And this kind of primary season, I was very surprised at how many young people were as excited by Hillary Clinton's candidacy as they were by Barack Obama's candidacy. And recalling my own first time voting, I said, you know, my choice was Dukakis. And so how exciting for them that they actually had two candidates that they were even excited about. But I did not see so much of a age gap. I definitely felt the way it played out in the media, there was a lot more excitement for Hillary Clinton coming from the old guard of feminism, and there was a lot more excitement for Obama among younger people, but I saw an equal number of younger people excited by Hillary. And bringing it back to, I think, this concept of post-gender, I think if there's any way that – if there's any truth to this term, it's that we're evolving, and I think that maybe up until this point you see a candidacy like Hillary Clinton's or – a candidacy like Barack Obama's primarily benefiting those constituencies. Oh, we want to vote for Hillary Clinton because that'll be good for women. Mm-hmm. We want to vote for Barack Obama because that'll be good for blacks in America or good for non-white people. And I think that we're reaching a point where we're recognizing that those candidates could just be good for America. Mm-hmm. And I did a voter registration drive back in 1992, and I went into it thinking that I was helping voters who were not previously registered. And I thought, oh, how good of me and noble of me to go into these underserved communities and help these voters get connected. And it was kind of this epiphany halfway through where I went, oh my gosh, it actually is doing a disservice to me as an American if I live in a democracy that is not living up to that promise, if I live in a democracy where not the full percent or even the majority of voters are voting. And I think that that's a little bit where we are with their candidacies right now, or with the kind of these races behind us and in the midst of it, is, oh, it could be good for all of us if there was somebody not male or not white who was president of the United States.
Here's an email we have from Jane in Portland, Oregon, I'd like to read. As a 60-something white female women's libber, my take on Hillary's candidacy is this. It wasn't overt or covert sexism of the media that did her in. She didn't fail to win the nomination because reporters, for example, called attention to her cleavage. It was the sexism that she grew up with that did her in. Like many of us, Hillary took a long time to figure out who she was. There's a long learning curve to this equality thing, as all oppressed classes learn as they struggle on their way up. Hillary got better and better and more sure-footed as she campaigned. And last night she showed everything that she had learned. She's an object lesson for our generation and especially for the next. I wonder, Susan Faludi, what you think of that.
Well, I think it's very true that, and I think that was what was so moving about last night, was here was a woman who started out, you know, not an ideal public speaker, a bit wooden, a bit uncomfortable. And to see her evolve was thrilling, and I think gave a great sense of encouragement to not just women, but women in particular who, you know, who enter onto the public stage with trepidation and who get knocked down. And to see Hillary get knocked down time and again and get up and keep on fighting, as Harriet Tubman said, was very important for, I mean, we don't even know the young women out there who will take a lesson away from this and say, you know, maybe I'll try too.
Let's get Candy on the line. Candy's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
It's Candy, and I just called. I've been listening this morning. I have to say, I'm 38 years old, and it's really embarrassing to say this, but until about a year and a half ago, when I watched a documentary on HBO about Billie Jean King, I honestly had no clue how hard women had it. I cried because here I have my mother-in-law and her partner who are total feminists, and I was embarrassed that I went to college and I didn't realize, you know, what these women went through to get us where we're at. And I honestly had to just thank them when I saw them again and admitted that, you know, as sad as it may be, I had no idea. And the horrible thing about it is that it's almost going backwards, because I see in my nieces that they're so taking advantage of the freedoms that we have as women that they're actually focusing on more their sexuality and the attention that they're getting. And I think that we need to just put our efforts into teaching our daughters, our nieces, our neighbor girls, anybody that, you know, is around, let them understand what we actually have went through to get to this point. Because, you know, as a 36-year-old woman at the time when I saw this, I was just embarrassed. And I understand it now. And I think they would, too. And that's really what we need to do. Instead of, you know, taking our ball and going home, as the lady said before, we need to just refocus our efforts and educating and continuing that education.
And that documentary reduced now to a television ad where Billie Jean King is in a tennis battle against literally a caveman. I wonder, Amy Richards, what you thought of what Candy had to say.
Well, I think Candy, because we're the same age, I think that some of our responsibility to feminism is acting on the rights that other generations fought so hard for. And I hope that the way future generations express their feminism is both in the form of a thank you to Hillary Clinton and Shirley Chisholm and Pat Schroeder, but also in the form of running for office. It's kind of doing what other generations could not do. And so I don't fault people so much for not appreciating or respecting enough what came before, but I do fault them for not being able to act upon what's in front of them.
Well, how can you act upon it if you don't know it's there? I would love to have had the opportunity in even high school to have had a women's study class. When I was in college, I didn't take any women's studies. I chose other classes. But I think if it was something that was taught as early as high school, we may, you know, be in a position to, you know, shape our lives so that we can act on that at an earlier age.
Well, Liz Winstead, shouldn't American history include women's studies? Shouldn't it be part of it?
Well, I think yes. And the fact that we still live in a society where there's Women's History Month is a giant jumping off point as a problem. When we, you know, we take the month to celebrate it, and I do believe it's February, the shortest month.
No, that's Black History Month.
That's Black History Month.
That's Black History. The women
it's
is March, right?
Actually.
I'm sorry, I'm marginalizing everyone at this point. But I think that, yeah, we should, absolutely. And I think that why we don't is part of the reason we're having this discussion is, as you look at things and as women look at their goals, unless women are, you know, the people in power making the decisions, instead of, you know, white guys, we are going to still have a Women's History Month. You know, it's that women need to start being on the boards and being able to make the decisions in colleges and in corporations and nonprofits, where they are the ones saying we need to focus on women's issues and put them at the forefront of our society. Certainly,
Candy, thanks very much for the phone call. Please,
thank you.
Could I jump in here for a second? This is Susan.
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that. You know, the women's history is actually a remarkably recent phenomenon of the last, you know, 30 years, and that when the second wave of feminism got going, they had, you know, small self-teaching groups to uncover the news of suffrage, because it had been buried. It had been erased from history.
Susan is Susan Faludi. Yes, she's with us from KQED in San Francisco. Liz Winstead joins us from Minneapolis, and also with us, Amy Richards at our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a question from here in the audience at the museum.
Hi, my name's Nathan, and I live in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and go to school in New Hampshire, where I got to vote in the primary. Maybe as a white male, I don't have the most informed point of view on this, but it seems to me that Senator Clinton has been a godsend for feminism, both by creating a new mold for first ladies fighting for equal pay in the Senate and by making it easier for the next woman, maybe a Kay Bailey Hutchinson or a Janet Napolitano, to win. But I think had she won, she might have been a nightmare for her cause. Her supporters, fervor aside, the right wing, the talk radio, has succeeded in turning her into this polarizing figure despite her local popularity in New York and Arkansas. And I don't think she could have united us as president. And had she won, the first female president would have been remembered as a divisive figure and also one who had stopped the first black candidate. And I have to also wonder if the way she ran her campaign in the last 2 months and her husband's apparent reluctance to embrace Obama's candidacy could potentially hurt her next bid, or even the bid of another woman in 2012 or beyond.
I wonder. Susan Faludi, you want to start on that?
Oh, I don't think another woman running. I mean, first of all, any woman running, any woman who sticks her head out is, going to get the same kind of flack. And there will be particular things about that woman that the right wing will focus on. I mean, when we're talking about right wing commentators, you know, like Rush Limbaugh, who even found something vicious to say about Elizabeth Edwards. So, you know, you can't win with these people. But I think she has moved the ball forward, to use that charming male metaphor.
Thank you.
And that she has cleared, and she has absorbed. She's like one big shock absorber for all the women to come after her. And, you know, I think what would really help would be some self-examination on the part of the media, and not just the right-wing media, the mainstream media, that called her every name in the book, and we don't need to review it all here, but we all know it was pretty pretty awful. And yet, when invited to talk about the sexism in the media, and there was a recent New York Times story about it, Katie Couric was the only one who was willing to acknowledge a deep well of misogyny that is still very much present in the media and in American life in general.
I guess I'd like to jump in here and say, while I think that's all true, Hillary Clinton did not run a good campaign, and Hillary Clinton had a record that could be challenged on. And if you take gender out of it, there was real reasons why Democrats would look at her and say, she's not the candidate for me. So I think while we talk about the media, which I totally agree with, I think there was just horrible statements. By the same token, you know, when Fox News puts up a chyron that says baby mama about Michelle Obama, that didn't get nearly as much press. I mean, the sexism is out there, and it just shows, A, the ineptitude of corporate media, that they don't do investigative journalism, so they have all this crazy graphics and colorful, you know, uninsightful commentary. that leads us down the path of sexism. The first thing they do is talk about what she wears because they aren't smart enough to talk about her policies. I think that says about the media, but I just don't want to let Hillary off the hook as a politician, because I do think there was some glaring flaws, especially for progressive Democrats, in her record.
And I just want to add,
I think, but those are different, you know, that's a different issue. This is Susan. Yeah, Pallady, yeah, sorry. Yeah, you know, I agree. And certainly one could disagree. One can, and I do, have huge problems with many of her policy stance, and certainly her authorizing a vote to authorize the war, et cetera. But that's very different from, that's not a reason to call somebody Nurse Ratched or She Devil or all the other terms that were thrown at her.
And I don't mean to
this
cut you off, but
point
I wanted
I'm
to
making.
Let
that's
Amy
Susan,
get
that's the point I'm making.
Okay. Can I just jump in?
I think we're on the same page, actually.
Yeah, totally.
Let's hear from Amy.
This is Amy. I don't think that there's, I think that we're talking about the sexist comments. I don't think that there's necessarily more sexism out there than there is racism. I think that we just are more uncensored when it comes to talking in a sexist way. And so I think that there are many people who feel as protective of Obama as they did of Hillary Clinton. But I think that people know better than to kind of say these things. And so I don't – I know that there's been a lot in this primary about pitting race and gender against each other or kind of figuring out which is more paramount. And I think that the one way that race is more evolved is that people know not to say racial slurs against Obama in public settings, whereas we don't hold back when it comes to calling Hillary Clinton names and kind of reducing her to her cleavage.
Amy Richards, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave
it
there.
Yeah, that's okay.
Amy Richards, co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation. Her new book is called Opting In, Having a Child Without Losing Yourself. She joined us from our bureau in New York, and our thanks to her. We also heard from Susan Faludi, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. The paperback version of her book, The Terror Dream, Myth and Misogyny in Insecure America, is out next month. With us today from KQED, our member station in San Francisco, Liz Winstead is a comedian and host of Thinking and Drinking with Liz Winstead. With us today from Minneapolis in Minnesota, where the Republicans gather next week. Thanks to you all. We appreciate your time. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.